Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In his essay, The Biological Basis of Ethics, Peter Singer is going to discuss an important feature of reciprocal altruism, and he's going to offer what he calls some sociobiological explanations for how this could have arisen, why it would be important, and this has to do with the function of motivation or intention. If I'm behaving altruistically towards another person, that is, I am doing things that benefit them, perhaps to the detriment of my own interests or desires, you know, putting off, for example, my own desire to watch TV in order to help my kid with their homework, right? Things along those lines, staying afterwards to talk with a student, even though I'd rather go home and have dinner, something along those lines. Those are altruistic. Why do we do those? That's where intention or motivation comes in. And we can think of all sorts of self-interested motives that could be behind these seemingly altruistic acts. So why do I go the extra mile for a student? Because I'm hoping that that student will give me a good review on rateyourprofessor.com or some similar site, right? So I'm trying to get something out of it for myself. Why do I do that for helping my kid with their homework? Because I'd be so embarrassed if my kid was revealed as being a dummy who can't do basic mathematics, right? I'm invested myself. Or I'm trying to get them ready for the academic quiz bowl that I'm pushing them towards so I can bask in the glory of having a brilliant child or whatever else it's going to be. Trying to keep the teachers off my kid's back and therefore off my back. Those are self-interested motives. And so Peter Singer says that the practice of reciprocal altruism, that it should be the source of many of our attitudes of moral approval and disapproval, including ideas of fairness, cheating, gratitude, and retribution, would be easier to accept if it were not that this explanation seems to put these attitudes and ideas on too self-centered of a footing. So he says, reciprocal altruism seems as if it's not really altruism at all, but a concealed form of egoism, a concealed form of self-centered decision-making, saying, what am I going to get out of it? If I'm not getting something out of it, then I'm not going to contribute. Now, why would reciprocal altruism look that way and altruism per se not look that way? Because reciprocal altruism says you do good things for the person who also benefits you. Right? You don't benefit everybody indiscriminately. That would in fact be imprudent or foolish and lead to you being shortchanged. And likewise, reciprocal altruism would say not only the ones who cheat or don't reciprocate, can you feel certain negative feelings towards them like indignation or annoyance, but you might actually even take revenge on them. You might punish them for not reciprocating. So that seems rather self-interested. He says it might really just be accurately described as enlightened self-interest. And this is a true thing in many cases. There are a lot of people who are quite frank and upfront about the fact that they're only going to do stuff for you because they're getting something out of it. So he says one might be a fully reciprocating partner in this practice without having the slightest concern for the welfare of the person one helps. Concern for one's own interests, plus the knowledge that exchanges of assistance are likely to be in the long-term interests of both partners, that's all that's needed. And he says, now consider an example and see how this sits with you. So we've got, again, you know, saving somebody who is having a very rough time by drowning. He says, if I'm drowning in a raging surf and a stranger plunges in and rescues me, I shall be very grateful. And we show this in all sorts of ways. What if we find out, he says, that the stranger recognized me as being a person of means and then did a mental calculation and said, it's going to be profitable to rescue this person. They will probably give me a nice reward. And somebody else is drowning further down the beach and they're like, well, that person's retirement portfolio is not quite so good. I'm going to let them drown. Well, we would feel a sense of something being wrong there. right? We would say that that's the wrong motivation to have, and we wouldn't see that person as being genuinely altruistic. And he says, it's not only gratitude that diminishes when self-interested motives are revealed. Moral approval is always warmest for acts which show either spontaneous concern for the welfare of others, or else a conscientious desire to do what is right. Proof that an action we have praised had a self-interested motive almost always leads us to withdraw or to qualify, to lessen our praise. So Singer says, well, maybe we went wrong in how we defined altruism. So he says earlier in this chapter, here's the definition that we accepted in terms of behavior. Altruistic behavior is behavior which benefits others at some cost to oneself. Now notice that that has nothing to say about intention or motivation, why we're doing it. It just says this is what we're doing. So he proposes that we should redefine it in a different way. He says when people talk about altruism, they're normally thinking both of behavior and of motivation. So we should redefine it as this, and here's his proposal. Behavior that benefits others at some initial cost to oneself and is motivated by the desire to benefit others. And we might actually expand this and say benefit or to protect or help out others. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a positive benefit. It could be trying to save them from something bad as well. And, you know, it's interesting if you think about some of the actions that we take or don't take every single day, you know, some of them could be altruistic in motivation. For example, we know from, you know, statistical analyses and self-reporting that most people do not wash their hands an adequate amount, and many people do not wash their hands at all after visiting the restroom. Even if they're working at a place where there's a sign that says employees must wash their hands before returning to work. And you can say, well, you know, why would you wash your hands? Well, it's protecting you, right? You keep yourself from getting sick. But it's really about, you know, protecting other people as well, isn't it? And, you know, this is one of those tiny little things that can contribute in so many different ways that often go unseen to the benefit and welfare of others, to protecting them from transferring diseases around, right? Driving, if not the speed limit, at least close to the speed limit, and being a patient and focused driver rather than, you know, looking at your phone or things like that, that's, you know, that could be an altruistic act. And you say, well, I want to do that just so I don't get in an accident, so the cops don't pull me over. You could also say, well, that's a good thing to do because I don't want to hit other people or damage their cars or create dangerous situations. So motivation would matter then. And he says that let's think about how this would play itself out in terms of an evolutionary schema or explanation. He says, Robert Trivers has offered a sociobiological explanation for our moral preference for altruistic motivation. Why is it that we prefer other people to be altruistic? One reason, this is very simple, almost commonsensical, is that people who are altruistically motivated make more reliable partners in whatever exchanges or other relations that we're involved in. More reliable than those motivated by self-interest. How so? Well, you can say if they really care, at least some amount, about how other people are going to be affected, positively or negatively, they will do the right thing even when nobody's watching. Even when it's going to cut into their profits a little bit more, even when it might be a little bit more psychologically difficult, they can be relied upon. And he says, after all, one day the calculations of self-interest may turn out differently. And he's got goes back to the beach example. He says, looking at the shabby clothes I've left on the beach, a self-interested potential rescuer may decide that the prospects of a sizable reward are dim. So we want people who will rescue us or do the other things that we want to do in similar circumstances, regardless of whether they're going to get something out of it directly. And so he says, evolution would therefore favor people who could distinguish self-interested from altruistic motivation in others, then select only the altruistic as beneficiaries of their gifts and services. So he's talking about how reciprocal altruism would function well. If evolution whether it's understood in purely genetic terms or also in terms of its interaction with culture, if these processes would lead to some things being favored and other things being disfavored, namely altruistic motivation, then it's important that we actually be able to distinguish between those. Because otherwise we can't reward those by being altruistic towards them who are being altruistic towards us, and we lose the reciprocity part because we would either end up not being altruistic towards them, or we're being altruistic also to the people who don't reciprocate, and then, you know, that's not going to be particularly helpful. And the person who is doing the good thing, has the right motivation, would just receive the same reward as everyone else. So that's part of the evolutionary explanation. He also thinks that there would be a selection for people who actually have altruistic motivations. I think it's important that we pause here for a moment and think about how strong of a claim Singer is making. Is he saying that evolution would select for people who are altruistic all the time or 95% of the time? No, he's not saying that. He's saying that these are tendencies. Even people who are altruistic a good portion of the time, at least in my experience, aren't generally so all of the time. It's a matter of a continuum. And so what would be favored here would be the person who's more reciprocally altruistic, and what would be disfavored would be the person who's less so in their motivation, if people can tell what the motivations are. And they may be able to tell what the motivations are because the person who's not actually altruistic is dumb enough to tell them and brag about it, or it might be that they have a better way of seeing through the ruses of social life. So this sort of selection would be going on. And he says that if there are advantages in being a partner in a reciprocal exchange, and if one is more likely to be selected as a partner, if one has genuine concern for others, there is an evolutionary advantage in having a genuine concern for others, assuming, of course, that we can see through a pretense of altruism by those who are really self-interested. And evolutionary theory then would also predict one further thing, that we would get better at developing pretense, but at the same time, the performance of the pretenders would probably improve. So there'd be sort of a dialectic or dynamic in there of moral hypocrisy and being able to read between the lines, you could say, being able to tell whether somebody is genuinely altruistic or not. And there, I think that we, you know, we probably get much more into the social than the biological, but that's a little bit of a speculation there. What are the implications in Peter Singer's view for the sociobiological perspective that he is laying out here in the paper? He says, "This conclusion is highly significant because it cuts across the tendency of sociobiological reasoning to explain behavior in terms of self-interest or the interests of one's kin." So this would lead to a better, more robust, more complicated account on a sociobiological basis. He says, "Properly understood, sociobiology does not imply that behavior is actually motivated by the desire to further one's own interests or those of one's kin. Sociobiology actually says nothing about motivation because it remains on the level of the objective consequences of types of behavior. But," he says, "it is a common assumption sociobiology implies that we're motivated by self-interest, not genuine altruism. This assumption gains credibility from some of the things that sociobiologists write." And then Singer says, "We can see now that sociobiology itself can explain the existence of genuinely altruistic motivation. Not just concealed self-interest, but genuinely altruistic motivation that would have developed in our development, our ancestry, our whatever you want to call it, the mishmash of prehistory behind us of all those generations of human beings." So this is kind of an interesting point to develop with respect to sociobiology, but we might look at it in a broader sense and say that what Singer is saying here has implications for accounts of ethics generally, that it's really important that we'd be able to find some way of incorporating motives. Why? Because that is how people actually do judge whether people are altruistic or not. They focus on why a person is engaging in the action.
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.